I'm calling the Education Committee to order. It is 8 o'clock on Monday, March 11, 2024. Currently, we have President Representative McKay and Co-Chair Ruffridge, myself, Representative Allard, and I'm going to take a brief at ease. Okay, I'm calling the Education Committee back to order. I'm going to go ahead and acknowledge that we have Representative Hemshoot here, Representative Story, Representative McCormick, and Representative Prox. We also have Linda Jensen with our House Records, Zach Lawthorne with LIO. And let's see here. We have two bills on the agenda today. The first one we're going to hear is HB 71. This is the school district online checkbook by Representative Rauscher. Then we have HB 280, school funding local contribution by Representative Prox. First, we will be hearing the presentation of charter schools by, we're going to bypass that one. We're going to come back to it until our teams is set up. So our next item of business is going to be HB 71, school district online checkbook by Representative Rauscher. This is the first hearing this year on the bill. We will be hearing invited and public testimony. I'd like to invite Representative Rauscher forward and his staff to the table. If you could please put your name and yourselves on record and give us a refresher on this bill. I believe we also have Karen Morrison here, Director of Finance and Support Services for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development, on the line to assist on answering any questions. Go ahead, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard and Co-Chair Ruffridge,
committee members. Representative Rauscher, could you speak a little bit closer to your mic? And if you, Zach, if you could turn the volume up. Okay. Yes, just a minute, please. Brief at ease. Call the Education Committee back to order, and I wanted to acknowledge Representative Ortiz here today. Thank you, Representative Ortiz. You're the man. Okay. Representative Rauscher, if you can begin with your presentation, please.
For the record, my name is George Rauscher, District 29. I want to thank co-chairs Allard and Ruffridge for hearing this bill, as well as the committee. I really appreciate the fact that we're hearing it today. An act relating to education and relating to a school district online checkbook, HB 71. Schools around Alaska spend millions of dollars each year without a clear understanding of where the money goes. We believe it goes everywhere from school supplies to office supplies to teachers' salaries, administrative workers, and hopefully the kids in the classroom. A tool like online checkbook will help the governor and legislators understand where the deficit is and where funding is needed. Public accountability helps ensure that funds are spent wisely and the public is entitled to understand where the funding actually goes. The intent of the online checkbook is to create a free, searchable website that provides Alaskans with easy access to detailed and comprehensive information on school district spending. This will encourage better understanding of district needs and ultimately help ensure funding is directed to where it needs to go. Right now, I'm going to turn this over to my chief of staff so he could we've already done a quick session also. We do have invited testimony online if right, you want so to hear from them.
Thank you. So we have were you wanting to go to your invited testimony? Okay. Sure. So Ms. McCollum, are you online, please?
I am.
Okay. Ms. McCollum is on the MATSU school board, correct? Okay.
Right.
So thank you for being here today and thank you for your service. If you wanted to go ahead and give us your thoughts on this, that would be wonderful.
Thank you. I am Kathy McCollum. I'm the vice president of the MATSU school board. I'm here speaking on my own behalf today, though. just to give some information about what we currently do in the Mat Sioux School District, and just to advocate for transparency, accountability in public funds and fiscal responsibility. We have, I think, maybe it is a unique situation here in the Mat Sioux Borough School District. We have pretty much all of this online right now. Currently, we have our budget, and for the last 10 years, approximately, posted online. We have our annual comprehensive financial reports, which are more detailed for the past 10 years online. And we have a financial dashboard, which is expenses by object. We realize that that is a fairly difficult way for the public to view it currently. So we are in the process of switching over right now to a new budget development software called Gravity. And it uses an online type checkbook called Open Data. And we will be using that starting in June because we believe the public has a right to see how public funds are spent. So if I can answer any questions about that, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. We do have Representative Hemshute has a question for you, Ms. McCollum.
Thank you, through the chair, Ms. McCollum. What does the Open Data, is that the name of the software, is Open Data, and what does that cost?
Okay, the software we are switching to is called Gravity, and it's a budget development software. So the Open Data part of it is included with that software. So really, it will be a very small cost to us because we're using the Gravity system. I wouldn't say that it's free, but it is included. And according to our finance person, that this type of software is included in a lot of budget development projects or softwares. So I can't tell you the exact cost of it.
She has a follow-up. Go ahead, Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Chair Allard. Through the chair, Ms. McCollum, can you specify how much staff time is needed to use the Gravity software since the Open Data part of it is included? Is there any additional staff time?
I believe that we are switching to Gravity because it will reduce the staff time and make it easier for us. I absolutely have no knowledge of exact staff time.
Thank you.
I believe that if you're curious into staff time and exact costs, you could contact our finance person at the district. They'd be happy to answer those questions.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. Through the chair, and this might, it goes to the sponsor. Thank you, Rep. Rauscher. This bill, it doesn't require that a district would buy like Gravity or have to have a certain license for any program. It would just be required whatever system they're using that they would be putting this into the state checkbook.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair. Representative Story. No, it does not specifically call out for any specific software program itself. No, it does not.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Are there any other questions for the sponsor? I'm going to go ahead and open up for public testimony. At this time, I'd like to open up the board for public testimony. Is now open. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Is there anybody online that would like to testify? Hearing no one, public testimony is now closed. Having heard the presentation, we will now set aside HB 71. I'm going to set an amendment deadline for HB 71 for zero 8 o'clock for Wednesday. Actually, we're going to do it, Wednesday at 5 p.m. March the 11th, 12th, 13th. And thank you, Representative Rauscher. Again, it's going to be March the 13th at 5 p.m. will be the amendment deadline. Thank you to your staff, too, Mr. McGee. Well, I'll take a brief at ease, and we're going to go on to the next bill. calling the Education Committee back to order. I will now invite Mr. Simnick. Mr. Simnick, can you, there you go. Can you hear me okay, Mr. Simnick?
Loud and clear, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much for being here. Could you please put, Mr. Simnick will be doing a presentation for charter schools. He's the Senior Director of State Advocacy Services for National Alliance for Public Charter Schools. First name is Russ. Mr. Simnick, can you please put your name on the record and begin your presentation?
Of course, Madam Chair. Russ Simnick for the record, R-U-S-S, S-I-M-N-I-C-K, National Alliance for Public Charter Schools.
Thank you. And if you could go ahead and begin your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to talk about charter schools today, and thank you for the attention that this body has put on this important issue. At the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, we created the National Model Law for Charter Schools back in 2009. Since then, we've had seven states that have enacted brand new charter school legislation. I'm talking about states that they weren't allowed before, and now they are. And I think we have three more that could come online next year. So, at the end of next legislative sessions in the Dakotas and Nebraska, I think we might have 49 out of 50 states with public charter schools. Overall, in that time, we've helped 37 states make policy improvements that increased, the strength of their law, as well as increase the access to public charter schools. And I want to stress, too, that we are a nonpartisan organization. We often work in a lot of Republican states, but we also work in some very blue states as well. Public charter schools are not a partisan issue, even though I think sometimes folks seem to think of them that way. But Democrat support for charter schools, there's been a lot of polling out on that. It's very high. And to give you an example, the District of Columbia has about a similar population as the state of Alaska, yet there are 128 charter schools operating in this very, very blue area of the country. In Alaska, we think that the one of the issues that you guys could address would be to address the big waiting list. It sounds like charter schools are doing very well there, but there's just so much more demand. And that really tracks with nationally, too. We have 3.2 million kids in charter schools now, but we have an additional 5.3 million sitting on waiting lists. So we could be serving 8.5 million students nationwide, but yet we're only serving 3.2 million because, there are policy changes that need to be made in order to give schools give students access to those schools. And overall, in the polling, nearly 80% of parents want the option to choose which public school their child can attend. So one policy area that we think can address this in Alaska is the authorization. The groups that play this important role in vetting out potential charter schools, approving them, and then providing oversight. And then once the school is up and they're providing oversight, after the charter contract renewal point is reached, then they make that decision whether to provide renewal to that charter school, to make significant improvements in that charter school, or to not renew that charter school if it's not performing. We recommend in our model law that there's a multitude of authorizer entities working in a state, and I'll go through some possibilities in just a minute. But what we mean is granting the authority to some entity other than just the local school districts. To date, only 13 states have one authorizing option, but only five allow only the school districts to be the sole authorizers. So looking at some types of authorizers, one that's very popular is higher education institutions, either public universities or a combination of public and private universities. They have a lot of advantages. They can bring considerable education expertise, best practices, and a lot of resources from their teaching colleges, for instance, to that. But they may not lack, or they may lack the experience with K-12, and just not really dive into the charters to the level that they should. So there's advantages and disadvantages. One very popular one that's come on in the last 5 or 6 years is an independent chartering board. What's really good about ICBs is that they can really focus on the work at hand and build up expertise in charter schools. But it's also creating more government, too. And we find, particularly in redder states, there's not a lot of appetite for that. We talked about the local school districts as authorizers, and they can do a very good job with that. But we find that, sometimes their primary focus is on the traditional school district. and they may not embrace or may even be hostile to chartering. And we also find that one of the biggest drawbacks with just allowing local education agencies is, you know, they have a lot of times a very traditional mind, and they don't have the appetite for innovation that charter schools do. And, you know, so we recommend that, you know, while they play that important role, hopefully, you know, some other authorizers can bring another mix to get some more innovation in schools and autonomy for them to operate. We do have some states that nonprofit organizations authorize. There's not a lot of states that do that, but some do. They can, you know, be highly visible and credible. They can foster innovation. But they may lack the expertise in charter authorizing to do that. And then finally, we call the state education agency or the Department of Education in a state. We see this as sometimes it's done straight through the Department of Education. Other times it's left to a state board of education or some other public commission in education to do that. They do have the educational knowledge and expertise and capacity. They have statewide authority. But just like local school districts, because they're you know, overseeing all the public schools in the state, maybe they don't have the time to focus on charter schools and give them the attention that they deserve. So we have advantages and disadvantages to all of these, but we would recommend that we don't but just best all of the Alaskan Charter School Authority in the local school districts. We would recommend, you know, the addition of one or more statewide authorizers. For instance, a higher education institution, and maybe the State Board of Education or the State Department of Education. And really, that is all that I have prepared. I want to leave maximum time for any questions that you guys have. And, you know, we would love to serve as a resource to you as you work through this very difficult but interesting and exciting topic.
Thank you, Mr. Semenik. I think everybody has a presentation in front of them. Are there any questions to Mr. Semenik? Oh, Representative Prox, please.
Yes, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Semenik, for your presentation. I guess my question has to do with if the state charters the charter school, does the state then provide more financial assistance, or is that still left up to the municipalities?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative. That is usually governed by the education funding formula in the state. We recommend that the best case scenario is that the state and federal monies go through the State Department of Education and then directly to the charter schools. It's easier. It's less burden on the local school districts to have to step in and be a middle agent in that. But yeah, those questions are guided by either they're in the traditional public school formula and get funded just like any other traditional public school, or there's a special per pupil amount specifically for charter school students, governed by any metrics you guys would want to develop. It could be a statewide average. Or it could be something to reflect the amount that the local school district would receive for that child.
Follow up through the chair. Do you have examples from various states that we might look at to see how to get some guidance on how to do that? Because that seems to be a concern that if the state is authorizing the charter school and there's a concern at the borough level or the local level that increases the local level's work without being compensated. And so I'm just trying to figure out if there's some examples of how this has worked in different states.
Through Madam Chair, Mr. Representative, yes,
we would. I apologize, Mr. Semenik, but can you, each time before you speak, can you put your name on the record?
Very sorry. Yes, for the record, Russ Semenik. Through Madam Chair to the representative, yes, we absolutely can give you, and if I guess I should just suggest that, you know, I could work with staff for the chair and provide you some examples of how different states do this. And including our model law, we have several different potential avenues of funding for schools. Be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hemshoop?
Yes, thank you, through the chair. I apologize. I'm going to have a number of questions here.
It's okay. Let me just clarify one more time. Mr. Sumnick, before you speak, just put your name on the record, and then that way the audience who's listening audio can they know who's speaking.
Understood.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Hemshoop.
Thanks. To the chair, my staff was out on Friday, and so I came in this morning to get ready, and I didn't even see this on BASIS, so I'm trying to take it all in. So through the chair, Mr. Sumnick, can you help me on page 5? Where is the – what would the category be for the State Board of Education? Is that the would that be equivalent to a non-educational government entity? Is that a State Board of Education?
Before you answer, and Representative Hemshoot, I do apologize, but Mr. Sumnick got us the presentation this morning. We'll work on getting it sooner in the future. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome.
For the record, Russ Sumnick, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's a very good question that you asked. We would put them in the State Education Agency bucket. Sometimes they're really controlled by the State Department of Education. Other times they have more of a parallel relationship. But generally, you're right. I would not classify them as a non-educational government entity because they clearly are educational, but they would more closely align with the State Education Agency.
Follow up?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair. So then, thank you so much. Mr. Sumnick, on the circle on page 6, so a State Board of Education, there isn't specifically any state using their State Board of Education as an authorizer. They're aligned with the State Education Agency, what we call DEED, Department of Education and Early Development. Okay, so I'm trying to digest the circle and figure out who's doing what. Do you have examples of states where the State Board of Education is the authorizer?
For the record, Russ Sumnick, Madam Chair, Representative, I can provide those to you. We do have quite a few examples of that.
I'll get that from him.
Okay. Thank you. Through the chair then, Mr. Sumnick, when you provide that, could you also then delineate for us of those state boards who are authorizers, which ones are appointed boards versus elected boards or combination boards where they're both appointed and elected? That would be really helpful for us to get an idea of how we're comparing with other states.
For the record, Russ Sumnick, Madam Chair, Representative, we would be happy to do that. I'm making a note right now.
Okay, thank you. One final follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I think my final follow-up question this morning, again, I'm digesting this as quickly as I can, but through the chair, Mr. Sumnick, when you say 49 and 50 states have public charters, can you outline for us where for-profit charter companies fall in those states? So Knowledge is Power program, that kind of charter, are they represented in all 49 of those states?
For the record, Russ Sumnick, Madam Chair, Representative. So let me clarify. I said 49 states. That was including three potential states that currently don't have charter school laws. So currently there are 45 states with charter school laws, but that wasn't the point of your question, though. To address your question, what you're talking about is called a charter management organization, and some of those are for-profit and some of them are not-for-profit. The vast majority are not-for-profit, for instance, KIPP. Most of the time, those do not contract directly with an authorizer to open a school, yet they are hired by the local community-based nonprofit that gains the charter, and then they would contract just like they would contract for other curriculum or textbooks, with an outside service provider, and that would be like a KIPP or a rocket ship or someone like that. But the vast majority of those are nonprofit. They are not many states have specific prohibitions against for-profit education service providers. That's more common. I don't know of any that that disqualify all education service providers. I believe most states would allow a KIPP or a rocket ship or concept school, some of these high-performing providers, to operate within the states.
And yeah, thank you, Mr. Simnick, to the chair. I'm very concerned that this presentation wasn't noticed. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's a rule against presentations not being noticed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Simnick. Are there any questions for Mr. Simnick? No. Anything? Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease. Thank you for being here, Mr. Simnick. We're going to take a brief at ease, and our final item today is HB 280, School Funding Local Contribution by Representative Prox. Brief at ease.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Calling the Education Committee back to order. Again, our final item number today is, our final item is HB 280, School Funding Local Contribution by Representative Prox. This is the first hearing on this bill, and we will hear the sponsor's introduction and invited testimony. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and Mr. Co-Chair, and members of the House Education Committee. For the record, I'm Representative Mike Prox from District 33, that's North Pole and the surrounding area. As we look ahead to the next school year, the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development anticipates educating over 127,000 students. This will cost approximately $1.53 billion. Our state's unique and diverse landscape is home to 53 school districts, each with its own set of challenges and needs. The state's funding formula has been designed to ensure that every district received what is termed a basic need, a measure of the necessary funds to provide basic education. However, the mechanism we currently employ to fund this basic need is flawed. In the late 80s, the state took full responsibility for funding this basic need, but fast forward today and we find that only 75% is met by state funding. The shortfall is expected to be covered by what is called a required local contribution from 34 of our 53 school districts. And this is the required local contribution is calculated on a 2.65 mil tax levy. And this has created a disparity in our communities, dividing them between those who are required to contribute locally and those who are not. It's a system that inadvertently promotes inequality and undermines the spirit of our state's commitment to education. Our state constitution states that public education is a responsibility of state government. It is both an acquired right bestowed upon our children and a duty assigned to us as legislators to establish and maintain a system of public schools. The Mandatory Borough Act of 1963 further emphasizes that no area should suffer from a lack of state resources, revenues, or assistance due to its incorporation status. Unfortunately, the current funding model, particularly the required local contribution, stands in contrast to these mandates. House Bill 280 seeks to address these challenges head-on by removing the mandatory local contribution and restoring that responsibility of funding schools back to the state. This approach honors our constitutional and legislative mandates, ensuring that every child in Alaska has access to quality education without placing an undue burden on individual communities. By doing so, we not only uphold our commitment to public education, but also empower local governments to allocate additional resources toward enhancing educational opportunities, providing tax relief, and meeting other community priorities. So, in summary, House Bill 280 seeks full funding for basic need by the state for all school districts. Full funding of basic need would honor constitutional intent by ensuring the state takes the lead in adequately funding education without disproportionately burdening individual communities. It would eliminate one of the most onerous financial burdens placed on taxpayers of existing organized municipalities and allows local governments to provide additional funding for education, property tax relief, and/or other priorities, and would remove the biggest financial disincentive to incorporate new boroughs. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
My staff, Maggie Elliott, will go over the sectional if you would like. And we also have invited testimony.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Prox. I will now read the sectional analysis for House Bill 280. Section 1, conforming amendment removing reference to the required local contribution under the funding for charter school section AS 1403-260. Section 2 amends 412020C by replacing the reference to regional education attendance areas with districts of the state public school system described in AS 1412010, which includes city school districts, borough school districts, and REAAs. This section also amends language from requiring a local contribution from borough and city school districts to making additional local contributions optional. Section 3 amends 1417410B by removing language requiring a local contribution from the calculation of state aid and amends the rest of the subsection section with conforming language. Section 4 to 9 amends statutes as seen with conforming language. Section 10 amends 2945050M to allow municipalities to completely exempt property taxes for an economic development property. Currently, only the amount above the school district's local required contribution may be exempt. Sections 11 and 12 amends 4323220D and 4323230C with conforming language. Section 13, AS 1417410D, 1417410E, and 1417410F, each relating to required local contributions, are repealed. And Section 14 adds an effective date of July 1st, 2024. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You. Representative Prox, can we go ahead and move on to your invited testimony?
Before we do that, I need to point out this is kind of a long bill, and most of it's conforming language, but there is an error, drafting error. On page 2, line 21, we'll have to make a correction. The word minus should not be deleted in the bill. So,
thank you.
Details.
Okay.
Yes, so we do have invited testimony, and I believe that Savannah Fletcher, the chair of the North Star Borough Assembly, is online.
And I will read off the rest if you don't mind.
Please.
Okay, so we have Savannah Fletcher, Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly member. The presiding officer is online for invited testimony. We also have Assembly member, we have three more. We have Dan Bockhurst, herself, and then Lori Weed, Acting Facilities Manager, Department of Education. And we also have Brandy Hardy. Ms. Fletcher, if you'd like to put your name on the record and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Yes, good morning to the House Education Committee. My name is Savannah Fletcher, and I'm the presiding officer of our Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. I really thank you for this time to speak in support of this bill, of HB 280, because this is one of the key pieces if we want to find sustainable solutions moving forward for state and local communities to help support our schools. We need to get rid of the required local contribution. As Representative Prox said, it imposes an ever-growing burden on our local taxpayers and our local budget when we actually see a decrease in the amount of state funding to our schools. just to look at the zoomed out statewide picture, and then I'm happy to zoom in on our local community and its impact. For example, from last year, fiscal year 24, the state legislature had a basic need calculation of $1,532,000,000 approximately for schools. It's gone down by $2 million this year to $1,530,000,000. And yet we have seen a $13 million increase on the burden shifted to all the local municipalities. So even as the state calculates less in basic needs, we have our local boroughs and cities with school districts paying more out of their tax base to help fund to the basic need. And I think this is a really critical thing to understand, because the required local contribution is not tied to your student enrollment, is not tied to your school's fiscal needs, but it's really based on a 2.6 mil calculation of your real and personal properties in a community. So for our borough specifically, this year we're up to about $38.6 million in required local contribution. And that's just to show from last year, again, an increase of $1.3 million approximately. And this year on the table for us is the potential closure of four schools, including one on our Ben Eielson Air Force Base. And that alone, that school's closure is saving about $1.3 million. So you see the direct impact of these annual increases on our mandatory required local contribution and how that plays out for our school district, because we have had approximately flat funding towards our school district over the past few years based on how much tax revenue we're collecting. But the school actually feels a negative hit in how much funding they get every single year from the borough, because more and more of that is actually going towards the state's responsibilities of the school district. And it leaves us with less ability to give additional funding on top of that to our school district at the local level, lest we really feel a hit of an ever-increasing property tax burden on our community. And at a time when I know everyone at this committee is aware, costs are going up exponentially for community members. And if we continue to hit them here, they need to pay even more in property tax just to stay flat, just to stay equal with how much we funded our school district the year prior. It's really not a sustainable solution. And as Representative Prock said, it's a huge disincentive for other communities to ever want to incorporate, because they know with it will come this big responsibility, where currently the state is funding to the full basic need for those communities that aren't incorporated with their own taxing power. So I guess I really am just speaking here to underscore a few policy points that make this a really smart bill to move forward. One, getting rid of the required local contribution will encourage economic growth. Right now, anytime you have an increase in your personal or real property, you are now going to be hit more with a higher required local contribution to help the state cover its basic need calculation. Second, getting rid of required local contribution would encourage incorporation, as more and more communities may not currently be incorporated but using state services. Maybe we want to encourage them to become their own municipality, their own borough. But so long as the required local contribution is hanging over as a threat, it really disincentivizes that. Third, the required local contribution, as I said before, it's not tied to the number of students or schools need. It's really using an entirely unrelated metric, which is that real and personal property, and a 2.6 mil rate on that. And again, this directly leads to more property taxes every single year. Our borough, for example, 87% of our budget stems from property taxes, our tax revenue does. And that means if we have an ever-growing required local contribution, this demand from the state equates to directly more property taxes every single year in our community. And that is the kind of harmful thing. If we want to support families and their ability to afford to live here, we shouldn't be drawing on them to pay for this when it's really the state's basic need calculation is trying to fulfill. And the last thing I want to say is this would be an amazing opportunity for our local communities to chip in and to support schools more, as we're seeing a path forward for sustainable education funding. If we took the required local contribution off of the burden of only some communities, and instead the state paid it for every single school district community, that would give us the freedom to have that local control and expertise to know what can we sustain locally in terms of supporting our communities more. And we're already seeing this desire amongst different communities in the state to tax additional if they want to and if they're able to for their schools. But getting rid of the required local contribution would, again, better empower local governments to make that determination and actually have that be feasible and not have a tax increase be so detrimental to the economic well-being of that community because it's not in addition to the required local contribution. And I will just say specifically, as I mentioned before, our borough is facing a very great hardship this year. We are in a $28, $29 million deficit, assuming a small base student allocation increase. And I know our school board chair, Brandy Hardy, can speak to this in more detail later. But that means four potential school closures, including one on our military base. And it would be so harmful to those families and those communities. And this would be a very concrete way to immediately alleviate some of that hardship and allow us to provide additional funding to keep those schools open. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fletcher. Are there any questions for Mrs. Fletcher? Okay, we're going to move on to Dan Bockhurst. Are you there?
Yes, good.
Can you put your name on the record and provide your testimony, please?
For the record, my name is Dan Bockhurst, B-O-C-K-H-O-R-S-T. I'm a resident of Ketchikan. Very briefly, in terms of my background, I have had a 40-year career in local government here in Alaska, including 26 years as a senior local government specialist for the state of Alaska and chief of staff for the Alaska Boundary Commission, which deals with borough formation and borough annexation, city school district annexations. I've also served 10 years as the borough manager for the Ketchikan Gateway Borough. Over my 40-year career, I've dealt extensively with municipal boundary changes involving shifting of responsibilities regarding public education and delivery of public education by Alaska's 19 organized boroughs, 15 city school districts, and 19 regional educational attendance areas, or REAAs. During my tenure as borough manager, the Ketchikan Gateway Borough litigated the constitutionality of the required local contribution. The borough contended principally that the required local contribution was a state tax that violated the dedicated funds clause of Alaska's Constitution. We were successful at the Superior Court level, but the borough's success was reversed on appeal to the Supreme Court. Four justices participated in the appeal consideration. What's noteworthy is that half of those four indicated that there is an open question that would only be resolved if the question of the constitutionality of the required local contribution were weighed under the public schools clause rather than the dedicated funds clause that the borough chose to use. One justice stated outright, and I quote here, that he had considerable doubt that the required local contribution is constitutional. And I would strongly urge the committee to consider, there's a 32-page Alaska Law Review article on the Ketchikan case that was published in 2017. And I'd like to read briefly from a portion of that conclusion in the 32-page article. It states as follows. The required local contribution could be deemed unconstitutional under the Public Schools Clause. Given the current budget crisis, the state would face a significant financial problem if a challenge to the required local contribution were successful. Thus, the state should begin researching additional resources and methods of funding. Conducting this important analysis now will help the legislature avoid scrambling for a solution only once it is forced to do so and correct disparate funding responsibilities between citizens in different types of school districts. House Bill 280 before you is certainly a step in that direction. Beyond questions of constitutionality, as others have spoken here today, there are significant concerns, and those have existed for decades, over the unfair treatment of school districts in Alaska. There are 34 school districts, 19 boroughs, and 15 cities that are heavily penalized by the required local contribution. while 19 other school districts, regional educational attendance areas, escape any penalty. In terms of the specific bill before the committee, if House Bill 280 were enacted, in my view, it would be the most significant local government legislation since the 1963 Mandatory Borough Act. Imagine serving in the legislature in 1963. It was the beginning of the fifth year of statehood. The people of Alaska generally had no interest in forming boroughs. In fact, many were adamantly opposed to it. Jay Hammond, who at the time was a member of the House of Representatives, commented as follows. He said, "Attractive enough on paper, in practice, the organized borough concept had little appeal to most communities. After all, why should they tax themselves to pay for services received from the state gratis?" Victor Fisher, a Constitutional Convention delegate, wrote that there was little enthusiasm in the state for the unknown and untried form of local government. There were also pockets of intense local opposition, particularly in areas outside independent school districts. Yet members of the 1963 legislature knew that the structure for local government under our Constitution required change. Thus, they took the incredibly forceful action to mandate borough formation in 8 of the most populous parts of Alaska to form boroughs. The 1963 legislature understood the people's hostility and resentment over being forced into organized boroughs. Therefore, the bill was written with the intent that organized boroughs would not be penalized because of incorporation. That was mentioned earlier by one of the individuals speaking. That's not a matter of speculation. The legislative intent is articulated clearly in the Mandatory Borough Act. Specifically, Section 1 of Chapter 52, Session Laws of Alaska, 1963, states in part, "It is the intention of the legislature that no area incorporated as an organized borough shall be deprived of state services, revenues, or assistance, or otherwise penalized because of incorporation." That legislative intent cannot be fulfilled as long as the required local contribution exists. In the current fiscal year alone, the required local contribution deprives 19 organized boroughs of more than $290 million in state funding for education. Additionally, the 15 home rule and first class cities in the unorganized borough are deprived of more than $11 million in state aid. House Bill 280 would rectify that longstanding injustice by aligning state law with the original intent of the 1963 I urge you all to support that bill. Thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bockhurst. That was very good, informative. Are there any questions for Mr. Bockhurst? I'm looking at Representative Story. No? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bockhurst. Your presence was greatly appreciated. Ms. Lori Weed, you're next. Is she still on the line? Ms. Weed, would you like to put your name on the record and give your testimony, please?
Hi, this is Lori Weed, School Finance Manager for the Department of Education and Early Development. I'm available for questions. I don't have any testimony.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Weed. Oh, we have a question for you. Ms. Representative Story, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. And this may be a better question for the sponsor of the bill, but Ms. Weed, I'm looking at the fiscal note and it said there's zero fiscal note. And just based on the last testimony, I think it would be like a $301 million fiscal note because if the local,
I'm sorry, Representative Story, if I can help you out, there's like four different types of fiscal notes. If you go to, I think the fourth one, you'll see the numbers there for you. I apologize.
Thank you. If I can just, I'll look at this and then have a question.
Sure. Okay. We have next is Ms. Brandy Hardy. Would you like to go ahead and put your name on the record and begin your testimony?
Hi, my name is Brandy Hardy, and I am the current president of the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Board of Education. Over the last three decades, the burden of financing the educational system in Alaska has dramatically shifted from the state to its local municipalities. The state-mandated local contribution reduces the state's obligation to pay the basic need by 2.65 mils on the community's real and personal property for the city's government and for city governments that operate school districts and organized boroughs, but not in unorganized boroughs or REAs, making the required local contribution, in essence, a hidden tax on the taxpayers of first-class cities and organized boroughs. To add insult to injury, it is also my understanding that the RLC is capped at 45% of the total basic need, leading to some communities who are required to pay this hidden tax to pay a much higher rate than others. I have sat and listened in local community members testify about the ever-increasing property taxes and say they are looking to moving to communities like Delta, which is in fact an REA that does not collect property taxes and receives the full basic need funding from the state. This hidden tax is increasing local property tax values to a point where we are losing people from our tax base to places that pay nothing to support their schools. The RLC is pitting our local taxpayers' ability to afford to live in our borough against our school district's needs to operate and maintain an adequate system of public schools in our borough on behalf of the state. If the RLC were removed locally, it would free up nearly $37 million of community taxpayer money that could be used to fund its schools, lower property taxes, and still have money left over to invest in other much-desired capital improvement projects that would help entice more people to come to our borough to live and work and would undoubtedly help to stop the out-migration of people from our community. Currently, we have four schools up for consideration for closure this year, only 2 years after already closing three other schools. Removing the RLC would dramatically improve our community's ability to support its schools and stop the need for further closures. Our local borough assembly and school board passed a joint resolution that I hope many of you, especially member Prax, have seen, where it specifically asks that you please pass this legislation and fund the basic need. Fairbanks can no longer afford to pay this hidden tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hardy, for your testimony. Representative Story, do you have any questions? No? Okay. Okay, Representative Prox, is there anything else you'd like to follow up, or is there anybody you'd like to ask Representative Prox questions? Okay, it looks like you have two. So we're going to start with Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Allard. Thank you for putting this topic in front of us today, Rep. Prox. When I look at the $314 million that the state would pay then and free up that money for districts, I'm thinking about, again, all areas across the United States, and paying for schools is one of the biggest local contributions through property taxes that happens. And I'm thinking about the comments about the REAAs not paying any local contribution. And I'm just wondering if you're aware of the impact aid dollars that we get for our unincorporated, for some of our unincorporated areas, to the tune of about $70 million, I believe. And rather than the state pass that on to the districts, we keep that as part of their local contributions. But as I'm talking out loud.
Representative Story, do you have a question?
I think so. Thank you. Sorry about that. Just trying to set a little context there. That money's, my understanding, would go to them. But the point you're trying to make is that they don't have to pay anything themselves, even though they are giving up that income, so to speak, that the state takes it as their kind of contribution that they are making. And so we're, quote, depriving them of that $70 million. And so you would be saying that $70 million should go to the REAs too. And so this more than $300 million. So I guess my question was, should this also be included? Are you wanting the $70 million to go to the REAA school districts and that we do not get that local impact aid anymore? If we would be doing this, wouldn't we want to pass on the impact aid and us pay the $70 million?
Representative Prox, before you answer that question, I just want to bring up to the committee, when you have a question, ask the question. If you want a platform, let him respond, and you can come back with comments at the end of the committee. Go ahead, Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. This is Representative Mike Prox. Through the chair, that where the federal impact aid goes is really a separate question. What this bill tries to deal with is inequity between organized boroughs and basically unorganized boroughs and the rural education attendance areas. The point we need to address is that the two groups are being treated differently. Mm-hmm. And our state constitution says that everybody is supposed to be treated equally under the law. So that's a factor, because we're talking about a big chunk of money. We have to think about that. We might have to address that as well. Don't know. But this particular bill just deals with the inequity between the organized boroughs and the unorganized borough, if you will.
Follow-up.
Hmm? If you have a question.
Yes. Thank you for your perspective on that, but I would say that we would have to include
Gibbons. If you have a question.
I would encourage you to think about that. We possibly do have to include that $70 million, because then we would be treating them
unfairly. Representative Story, do you have a question?
Are you going to look at thinking about that?
We're going to think about that. You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, the $314 million, where does that come from?
That comes out of the state budget, out of the state general fund, I guess.
Thank you.
Representative McCormick.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative McCormick. Representative Prox, I was wondering if you might be able to expand on what you mean by the inequity between organized and unorganized boroughs.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Through the chair, this is Mike Prox from District 33. The inequity comes that the state is mandated to provide and maintain a system of public schools, and they maintain that differently between they require organized boroughs, organized areas that are being charged 2.65 mils on the real and personal property tax. And in the unorganized boroughs, they are not being charged for that. That is inequitable.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Prox, it's my understanding you visited Napakiak this summer, correct? Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you might expand on the inequities that you might see in terms of lifestyle and economic opportunities from the district that you represent and maybe rural Alaska.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. This through the chair. This is Representative Prox. Yes, I certainly do appreciate the difference in, if you will, ability to pay. This is a big question. This is a huge, 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 huge question that we have to address, because we do have, you know, like it or not, we do have a constitutional issue before us.
Did you have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Prox. One of the testifiers what? I completely forgot my question. Yeah, right. I apologize.
Okay, we can come back. It looks like Mr. Bockhurst could answer. I don't see him online, though. Looks like he hung up. Is he online? Representative Story, it looks like he can answer one of your questions. So we're going to circle back around. Mr. Bockhurst, could you answer Representative Story's question, please?
Excuse me.
Dan Bockhurst. In terms of the question being impact aid as a support by the regional educational attendance areas, is that my understanding what the question is?
Representative Story, would you like to readdress your question or re-ask it, please?
Through the chair, to... I'm sorry, I didn't catch your last name. I believe my question was answered with the $314 fiscal note. But yes, if you wanted to answer the question, what you felt about if REAA funds should then go directly to the school districts and the state not, and the state not keep that money.
Okay. I've heard in my...
Mr. Bockers, could you put your name on the record, please, and then begin your answer?
For the record, my name is Dan Bockhorst. Question certainly has been raised in the past whether federal impact aid is equivalent of a local contribution to the requirement for a contribution by municipal governments. And I think for a number of reasons, that is not a reasonable interpretation. First of all, federal impact aid is not unique to regional educational attendance areas. In fact, two-thirds of municipal school districts in Alaska also receive federal impact aid. Anchorage and Fairbanks alone contribute more federal impact aid to the state under the Education Foundation formula than the total contributed by two-thirds of all regional educational attendance areas. Thus, if the impact is to be impact aid treatment is to be considered a required contribution from REAs, then it must also be considered a second required contribution from municipal school districts. Second, while municipal school districts must make a required local contribution, not all regional educational attendance areas receive federal impact aid. And lastly, there is nothing local about federal aid. Citizens, businesses, industries, and others in the REAs are free of any obligation for financial support of their schools. There's no local cost for schools and REAs. And in contrast, I think it's been raised here today, areas within organized boroughs and city school districts are forced to pay more than $300 million to lower the state's cost of education. That $300 million is indeed a local cost. So in summary, federal impact aid is not in any sense a penalty for REAs, the way it's treated under the foundation formula. To the contrary, REAs retain 10% of their federal impact aid in addition to receiving 100% of basic need. Contrast that with municipal school districts, which receive on average only 76% of basic need. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for? Okay, Representative McCormick, go ahead.
Thank you, through the chair. I remembered my question now. So, Representative Prox, one of the testifiers said that if this were to pass, it might encourage unincorporated boroughs to become incorporated. Do you share that sentiment that you really think that this would make a significant enough of a difference, maybe in a community like my own? Do you really believe that this would encourage them to incorporate? That's my question.
Thank you, through the chair. This is Representative Prox. Representative Frank. It's hard to say. It is an obstacle for, or a disincentive, I should say, for some of the communities throughout the state. I don't know. That is up to the individual communities. This just addresses what appears to me to be inequity. It's costing the local governments. Another part of this that I don't know, in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the borough does not impose a tax on personal property, but personal property is included in the state's calculation of total property. And that adds another complication.
Are there any other further questions for go ahead, follow up.
Thank you. Not a follow up, separate question. Perhaps I apologize if this speaks to my misunderstanding of the bill, but I guess there's one question that I have. swirling around right now. And through the chair, please stop me if I'm editorializing here, but you know, sat through subcommittee finance meetings. We've cut funding for domestic violence shelters, critical public radio services, public health funding for tuberculosis, even the necessary digitization of evidence has been denied funding. I guess with this, it begs the question for me, why should I feel at all confident the state will uphold its end of the bargain and adequately fund our schools if this is to pass, when we're already cutting funds to a number of necessary services?
Representative Prox.
And thank you, through the chair. This is Representative Prox from District 33. Representative McCormick, you make a good point. We've got some big decisions to make, but we do have these inequities. It's Constitution drives it.
Are there any other comments or questions? Okay. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Prox. I know that my district suffers greatly for the inequity that the organized boroughs are carrying the water. It doesn't mean that it would impact rural communities in a way that would take money from them per se. It's reallocating funds to make it where the single mom in Anchorage or the single dad in Eagle River could live a little bit more comfortably. Okay. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anybody else that has any comments? No? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Prox. At this time, it looks like we don't have any more comments or questions from the committee. Having heard the presentation, we're going to go ahead and set HB 280 aside. I'm setting an amendment deadline for HB 280 on March the 13th, Wednesday, for 5 p.m. And thank you to Representative Prox and his staff. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 13th, at 08 o'clock. On HB 55, Extend Workforce and Best Board Allocations, and HB 274, Screen Reading Intervention K3, having concluded our business for today at, let's see what time is it, 9:15, we are adjourned.